Debunking Preterism, Chapter 9, Coming on the Clouds. The cosmic events of the Day of the Lord will culminate in the glorious appearing of Jesus Christ from heaven. In the Olivet Discourse, the Master promised, "Then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory." Matthew 24:30. This verse is a conflation of Daniel 7:13, "Behold, with the clouds of heaven there came one like a son of man," Zechariah 12:10, "They will weep, and all the tribes," and possibly Isaiah 11:12, and others. The historic church has always taught that Matthew 24:30 is an unambiguous reference to the glorious return of Christ. Matthew 24:30 presents a dilemma for preterists, since they teach that it does not refer to the second coming of Jesus, but to first century events. Chilton explained, "What appears to pose a problem for this interpretation, however, is what Jesus says. Jesus seems to be saying that the second coming will occur immediately after the tribulation. Did the second coming occur in AD 70? Have we missed it?" Sproul framed the problem for preterism. Quote, "This passage describes the parousia in vivid and graphic images of astronomical perturbations. It speaks of signs in the sky that will be visible and the sound of a trumpet that will be audible. Perhaps no portion of the Olivet Discourse provides more difficulties to the preterist view than this one. This portion leads many interpreters to see a clear historical division between references to the destruction of Jerusalem and references to the parousia of Christ. These interpreters grant that the destruction of the temple and Jerusalem took place within the time frame of one generation, but insist that Christ has yet to appear in the clouds of glory. This is true of interpreters from both the liberal and the conservative ends of the theological spectrum." End quote. Wright claims that the coming of the Son of Man on clouds in this verse has nothing to do with his return, but is a symbol for a mighty reversal of fortunes within history and at the national level. The idea behind the verse, then, would be that the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple in AD 70 was the sign proving that Jesus had been vindicated, exalted, and enthroned as Israel's Messiah. Hannah Graff describes this approach, quote, "It is important to note that the sign is what shall appear. It is misleading to understand the phrase as meaning, then shall appear the Son of Man in the sky. The Son of Man does not appear. The sign appears. Then Christ defines what the sign signifies. It's the sign that the Son of Man is now in heaven." End quote. The discourse in the other gospel accounts reveals a significant difficulty for the preterist contention that the sign of the Son of Man, Matthew 24:30, is an event that signifies his coming, but is distinct from it. To demonstrate, Mark and Luke substitute Matthew's phrase, "the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven," with the simpler expression, "They will see the Son of Man coming in heaven," Mark 13:26 and Luke 21:27. The obvious conclusion is that the later writers understood the sign exegetically. In other words, the sign should be equated with Christ's bodily appearance in the sky. Most partial preterists teach that the Son of Man's coming, Matthew 24:30, Mark 13:26, refers to Christ's post-resurrection ascension to heaven. Hannah Graff claims that Jesus is clearly not descending to earth in his second coming, but rather ascending to the throne of the Almighty in vindication and exaltation. As Wright points out, the Greek word translated coming in this verse could be rendered going. The idea is that Jesus ascended to receive his kingdom and to sit at the Father's right hand until his enemies were destroyed in AD 70. Chilton explained that the directionality of Christ going away to his Father finds its basis in Daniel's prophecy of the Son of Man, Daniel 7:13-14. But notice exactly what Daniel says. Christ is seen going up, not down. The Son of Man is going to the Ancient of Days, not coming from him. He is not descending in the clouds to the earth, but ascending in clouds to his Father. Daniel is not predicting the second coming of Christ, but rather the climax of the first advent, in which, after atoning for sins and defeating death and Satan, the Lord ascended on the clouds of heaven to be seated on his glorious throne at his Father's right hand. End quote. This preterist interpretation of Christ's statement about his coming is counterintuitive and fraught with several difficulties. Perhaps the most troublesome is that it requires multiple comings. As DeMar admits, this view requires that preterists differentiate the Son of Man's coming from his coming on the clouds of heaven a few verses later. They interpret the former as a judgment coming of Jesus in AD 70, and the latter as his ascension. This interpretation is unlikely and forced, being necessary only to preserve a commitment to a preterist hermeneutic. In addition, the book of Revelation frequently echoes Christ's statement about the Son of Man's coming, and it presents it as a still future event and not to Christ's ascension. I will present this argument in more depth later in this chapter. Furthermore, many preterists teach that the Son of Man's coming in the Olivet Discourse points to the third coming of Jesus, specifically his reigning presence. For example, Wright develops the view that the disciples were interested in Christ's arrival in Jerusalem to reign as king, and that these verses represent, in a spiritual or figurative way, his coming to Jerusalem as the vindicated rightful king. Ironically, such preterist interpreters posit three different comings of Christ, yet these strongly contrast with the interpretation of the Apostolic Church because they leave no room in the Olivet prophecy for his glorious return. One appealing motive for preterists to interpret the Son of Man's coming, Matthew 24:30 and Mark 13:26, as his ascension, is to avoid what they deem to be a necessary admission of prophetic failure as put forth by higher critics and skeptics. Wright elaborates of this approach. As we have seen, neither the godly traditions of the church nor the sometimes less godly traditions of scholarship are used to reading the passage in this way. The godly are less likely to accuse me of scholarly trickery designed to get around what to them seems a clear statement of the future second coming of the Lord. The scholars are likely to accuse me of pious trickery, getting around the problem that Jesus seems to have been mistaken. End quote. Wright's solution is neither a comfort to the skeptics nor to the godly. At any rate, Hannah Graff, perhaps uniquely among preterists, claims to recognize some already and not yet aspects of Christ's statement about his coming. He suggests that this statement contains final consummation language to characterize a near future event. Hannah Graff's admission regarding Christ's coming with clouds shows his willingness to understand this as a declaration regarding his return from heaven. Yet, as we will see, Hannah Graff misses the fact that it echoes the language of the Old Testament to describe the Lord's glorious return. Daniel 7 in the New Testament. Contrary to preterist claims, the prophecy of Daniel 7 does not prove that Jesus spoke about his ascension to God the Father in the Olivet Discourse. The careful reader should notice that the prophecy does not indicate a clear temporal connection between the Son of Man's coming in the clouds and his ascension, his presentation before the Ancient of Days. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven there came one like the Son of Man, and he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. Daniel 7:13-14. This prophecy, consistent with the temporal ambiguity found throughout the prophets, contains the mystery of the twofold advent of Christ. Notice that the Son of Man receives the kingdom in order that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. Daniel 7:14. Later in this vision, these nations receive the kingdom as a possession. Daniel 7:18-22-27, a verdict awarded when the books were opened at the judgment. Revelation 20:11-15, as well as Daniel 7:9-10, 22-26. And Christ slays and throws the beast into the fiery flames. It is evident that this vision is bookended on one end by Christ's arrival in heaven, and on the other hand by his glorious return with clouds. To reinstate this, the prophet foresaw the ascended Jesus' acquisition of the kingdom before his Father and his future return in the Father's glory to consummate the kingdom. The book of Revelation provides clues about the temporal relationship between these two prophetic events. The Apostle John describes Jesus as having the title, One Like a Son of Man, Revelation 1:13, quoting Daniel 7:13, and displaying features reminiscent of Daniel's Ancient of Days. The hairs of his head were white, like white wool, like snow. His eyes were like flames of fire. Elsewhere in the book, the apostle saw the ascended Lamb before his Father's throne, having already ransomed people from every tribe and language and people and nation, and made them to be a kingdom and priests to our God. However, Jesus promised to later give his people authority over the nations, even as I myself have received authority from my Father. Revelation 2:26-27. The Son of Man has already received an international kingdom, and he will give it in totality to his people on the day of Christ. The judgment scene with thrones in Revelation 4-5 serves as a detailed retelling of the courtroom scene of Daniel 7. The comparative table above compares these scenes and demonstrates John's dependence upon Daniel. This is Chastity, by the way. You're going to have to just read it. It's a 3-page table. I will spare you the details. You can look at the book yourself. Back to the book. The courtroom judgment scene in the Apocalypse provides the prophetic backdrop of Christ being presented before his Father with the holy angels to receive a sealed inheritance scroll, Revelation 5:6-9. The text reveals that Jesus had previously redeemed his saints through death, and that he will give the full inheritance of the kingdom to them after opening the seventh seal, Revelation 8:1-2. As with Daniel, the apostle later received a vision of the Son of Man coming on a cloud of heaven, Revelation 14:14. The apostle John combined Daniel 7:13 and Zechariah 12:10 in the exact manner that Jesus did in the Olivet Discourse to present Christ's glorious appearance as a future event. Behold, he is coming with the clouds, and every eye will see him, even those who pierced him, and all the tribes of the earth will wail on account of him. The next verse shows that this coming is in the future, who is and who was and who is to come, Revelation 1:8. Elsewhere in the book of Revelation, the apostle presented the coming of Jesus as a future event, using such phrases as, I will come to you soon, until I will come like a thief, I will come, I am coming soon, behold, I am coming like a thief. As the reader should expect, the climactic event that answers to the book's theme in Revelation 1:7 is the revelation of the returning Christ, one like the Son of Man on a cloud and coming to earth, and arriving with his holy angels to slay the individual beast, throwing him into a fiery judgment. Using the exact language of Jesus, John's description of the cloud-riding advent of the Son of Man is decidedly future and does not describe his ascension. The overall message of the Apocalypse demonstrates that Jesus has ascended to receive the kingdom and will later appear on clouds of glory to bring judgment. Craig L. Blomberg points out that this observation accords with Christ's words to the Jewish Sanhedrin when he quoted the prophet Daniel to reveal this two-stage process of redemption. Quote, Jesus will shortly quote this passage from Daniel again, adding the phrase about seated at the right hand of power, i.e. God, in a different position than in the Old Testament text, so that Christ is first in God's presence, and then coming on the clouds, presumably, therefore, coming from heaven to earth. The picture is one of a theophany, which is always from heaven to the world of humankind. End quote. As an aside, the claim that the Messiah will arrive bodily with clouds, based on the prophecy of Daniel 7, is not unique to Christianity. It was explicitly taught within Judaism. The Babylonian Talmud explains that the Son of Man's coming with heavenly clouds describes Messiah's actual arrival to the Jewish nation. Quote, Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi noted a contradiction. On the one hand, it is written, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a man came, which implies that the Messiah will come swiftly. But on the other hand, it is written, a humble man riding on a donkey, which implies that the Messiah will come sluggishly. If the Jews are deserving, the Messiah will arrive on the clouds of heaven. If they are not deserving, he will come as a humble man riding on a donkey. End quote. The traditional Jewish expectation has always been that the Messiah will arrive bodily in Jerusalem at the end of the age. Some preterists correctly recognize that the language of Christ's coming in Revelation 1:7 pertains to the second coming. For example, Gentry betrays his apprehension about the preterist interpretation of this verse. Quote, "The initial impression this verse leaves on us today is that John is speaking of the second advent. It certainly does involve language quite applicable to the future, glorious, history-ending second coming of Christ. The scriptures speak often of a second coming, and even with this sort of cloud-coming judgment language. Yet, looks are deceiving." End quote. A literal, visible return. Many preterists argue that the Lord's phrase, "every eye will see him," is a metaphor for comprehension or insight and does not refer to actually seeing the glorified Jesus. This interpretation communicates that many people came to understand that the glorified Christ was seated on his heavenly throne when they witnessed the destruction of the second temple. And she explains, they, those who saw the temple burning, see it in the sense we see how a math problem works, with the eye of understanding rather than the organ of vision. First, every eye shall see him simply means that this will be a public event, not hidden in a corner. The Bible frequently uses all or every in a limited sense, far short of global universality. End quote. Nevertheless, other preterists evidence their hesitancy to deny to the universal scope of this language in their suggestion that Christ's statement alludes to the universal recognition of his enthronement, which supposedly occurred after the destruction of the Roman Empire several centuries later, and not because of the destruction of Judea and Jerusalem in AD 70. This statement of Jesus is a partial quote of the prophet Zechariah. A straightforward reading of Zechariah's prophecy reveals that the people of Judea and Jerusalem will gaze at the pierced Lord, and I, Yahweh, will pour out on the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem a spirit of grace and pleas for mercy, so that when they look on me, on him whom they have pierced, they shall mourn for him. Significantly, the Apostle John quoted this verse elsewhere with reference to those who visually looked at Christ's pierced body, and he echoed it again in the account of Thomas trusting in the glorified Jesus after seeing and handling his pierced body. In other words, in every New Testament occurrence of Zechariah's prophecy, people look upon the crucified flesh and bone body of Jesus Christ. In addition, Jesus added specific qualifiers to the prophecy of Zechariah that provide the reader with additional details regarding his return. The New Testament scholar G.K. Beale explains how these qualifiers function. The Zechariah 12:10 text has been altered in two significant ways. The phrases "every eye" and "of the earth" have been added to universalize its original meaning. The word "ye," earth and land, or "ye," cannot be a limited reference to the land of Israel. Rather, it is a universal denotation, since this is the only meaning that the phrase "asi hai phalai tes gis," all the tribes of the earth, how do you like that Latin, has in the Old Testament. Okay, maybe it's Greek. It's all Greek to me. The phrase "all the tribes of Israel" occurs repeatedly in the Old Testament, approximately 25 times, which highlights the different wording of Revelation 1:7b. I'm going to read that part again. The Zechariah 12:10 text has been altered in two significant ways. The phrases "every eye" and "of the earth" have been added to universalize its original meaning. The word "ye," land and earth, cannot be a limited reference to the land of Israel. Rather, it is a universal denotation, since it's the only meaning that the phrase "all the tribes of the earth" has in the Old Testament. The phrase "all the tribes of Israel" occurs repeatedly in the Old Testament, which highlights the different wording of Revelation 1:7. As Beale shows, the first qualifier, "all the tribes of the earth," is a technical expression found throughout the Old Testament that denotes the peoples and nations of the world. Consequently, this Greek phrase is not restricted to the 12 tribes of Israel, as preterists often argue. Furthermore, the second qualifier, "every eye will see him," strongly indicates an optical visualization of the risen Lord, especially against the backdrop of Zechariah 12, as argued above. A significant weakness of the preterist interpretation of Christ's statement that those who pierced him would see him coming on the clouds of heaven is that all or nearly all the men responsible for his crucifixion, in other words, the elders of the Sanhedrin present at his trial, had died long before AD 70. We can deduce this based on the requisite ages of the chief priests and elders at the time of Christ's trial, which took place nearly four decades before the fall of Jerusalem. In addition, we can evaluate the historical records, including the writings of Josephus, which chronicle many of their deaths. Consequently, the qualifier, "even those who pierced him," extends more universally beyond the scope of those who condemned and executed Jesus. This fact militates against the preterist view that such verses refer merely to those directly involved with his crucifixion. The implicit idea of these verses is that those responsible for the Lord's death, even if they themselves had died, would see his glorious return at the future day of Christ. Damar admits that the standard translation, "all the tribes of the earth," is correct only if the verse where this phrase is found refers to the second coming. Notwithstanding, the assumption that the context of this verse is limited to first century Jerusalem forces the preterist to revise the translation to "tribes of the land," meaning Israel's 12 tribes. This consideration heavily shapes their translation of the same Greek word wherever it appears in other biblical passages, especially in the book of Revelation. For example, Russell translated it as "land" in other passages instead of accepting the traditional rendering "earth." Russell even argued that the phrase "all the nations" found later in the Olivet Discourse should, with great probability, be equated with the tribes of Israel. He wrote, "There is no impropriety in designating the tribes as nations. The promise of God to Abraham was that he should be the father of many nations." Apparently, Russell was ignorant of the fact that the "many nations" of the Abrahamic covenant, Genesis 17:5, is not limited to Jacob's biological offspring, and that even in Abraham's lifetime, the patriarch sired other blessed Gentile nations, including the Ishmaelites and Edom. Another objection to the preterist view is that the overwhelming majority of Judean Jews did not receive a spirit of grace and pleas for mercy at the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. While the context of Zechariah's prophecy includes a military invasion of the land of Israel, it also contains the promise that God will subsequently give salvation to the tents of Judah, protect the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. These prophetic events did not occur when the Romans destroyed Jerusalem in AD 70, despite preterists' desperate attempts to allegorize the scriptures to suggest otherwise. The weeping and pleas for mercy should be understood as the humble pleading of national repentance, not the return of the glorified Christ, the Lord whom they have pierced. This exact vocabulary also appears in Jeremiah's New Covenant promise, specifically that God will regather the people of Israel back to their homeland. With weeping they shall come, with pleas of mercy I shall lead them back, Jeremiah 31:10. See also Jeremiah 54. Partial preterists critique the traditional view of Christ's return in the Olivet Discourse as being a primitive form of space travel. Yet, this is a double-edged sword for them because they admit that he will return in our future in the manner that they criticize, that is, by descending with the clouds of heaven. To illustrate, the Apostle Paul taught, "For the Lord himself will descend from heaven, then we who are alive will be caught up together with them," the resurrected believers, "in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air." Some preterists allegorize the meaning of Paul's words. However, the book of Acts also teaches that the Master will return literally and bodily by descending from heaven. "And when he had said these things, as they were looking on, he was lifted up, and a cloud took him out of their sight. And while they were gazing into heaven as he went, behold, two men stood by them in white robes and said, 'Men of Galilee, why do you stand looking into heaven? This Jesus who was taken up from you into heaven will come in the same way as you saw him go into heaven.'" Acts 1, 9-11. This passage shows that Christ's descent from heaven will take place in the exact manner that the disciples saw him ascend into heaven. Unsurprisingly for the futurist, this passage highlights two primary details about his ascension into heaven, specifically that it was accompanied by a visible cloud and that it was optically visualized by human observers. Cloud theophanies in the Old Testament. Preterists appeal to multiple Old Testament passages, in addition to Daniel 7, to support their view that the Son of Man's coming is not his future return. For example, they argue that the Old Testament theophanies of Yahweh coming on a cloud reflected a mere metaphor or symbol for his presence, judgment, and salvation. They put forth many biblical texts as supposed proof of this symbolic phenomenon of God riding on the clouds in judgment upon nations. Matheson expresses the common preterist sentiment that none of these texts is intended to communicate the idea that God is literally going to ride on a cloud into one of these nations. Yet an evaluation of these passages reveals that this contention is misleading and, at times, blatantly false. The phenomena of the Lord visually appearing in a literal cloud originates in the Pentateuch. The book of Exodus relates multiple narratives of Yahweh appearing to Moses and to the children of Israel in a cloud of glory. God descended in a thick cloud of darkness to protect and accompany the Israelites during the Red Sea crossing, the pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night. He also appeared in a cloud atop Mount Sinai to deliver the commandments of the law, descended to fill the tabernacle and to dwell among the children of Israel, and went ahead of the camp of Israel to lead them during their desert journeys. The cloud of his glory also filled the temple when King Solomon dedicated it. Preterists generally accept the concept that God appeared in a visible cloud during the Old Testament period. Nevertheless, Damar and others object, saying that this evidence is insufficient to support the futurist interpretation of Matthew 24:30 because God was not seen as physically present in these encounters. This objection is verifiably false because, as argued above, such Old Testament passages communicate that God personally arrived to Moses and to the nation, and he was accompanied by a visible cloud. But more importantly, the divine angel of the Lord, in other words, Yahweh in human form, the pre-incarnate Christ, appeared in the clouds. For example, this angel descended from heaven upon Mount Sinai, visibly appeared to Moses in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush, and introduced himself as God and as I am. This divine angel was corporeally present, contrary to Damar's argument, in the pillar of fire and cloud that accompanied the congregation throughout the desert. Then the angel of God, who was going before the host of Israel, moved and went behind them, and the pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them, coming between the host of Egypt and the host of Israel. And there was the cloud and the darkness. Exodus 14:19-20. Other passages also portray the Lord as appearing in clouds as a glorified man. Exodus 24:10-11, Isaiah 6:1-5, and verse 8, Ezekiel 1:26-28, Ezekiel 10:1, Daniel 7:13, Daniel 8:15. Finally, as argued previously, the New Testament expects Jesus to bodily and visibly descend from heaven when he returns. Acts 1:9-11 and 1 Thessalonians 4:16-17. Based on these considerations, the reader should understand that Jesus had in mind his glorious return as the incarnate, resurrected Son of Man when he prophesied that he would be seen coming on the clouds of heaven. Preterists point to a variety of other Old Testament passages to support their allegorical interpretation of Christ coming on the clouds. However, contrary to those claims, some of these passages do not describe cloud coming theophanies, but depict the clouds of darkness that will be visible on the day of the Lord. For example, Ezekiel 30, verse 3, Joel 2, 1-2, Zephaniah 1, 14-15. Other passages are found in the Psalms and prophetic portions of the prophets, and they recast the Exodus cloud theophanies in a poetic fashion. For example, the psalmist described God as coming with a cloud to deliver David from the hands of King Saul, Psalm 18, 6-17. Similarly, the prophet Nahum warned of divine judgment against Nineveh by quoting and alluding to the Exodus narrative, Exodus 25 in Nahum 1:2 and Exodus 34:6-7 in Nahum 1:3. He portrayed the Lord with clouds under his feet and rebuking the sea to make it dry land, Nahum 1:3-4, reminiscent of the Red Sea crossing, Exodus 14:21-22. The prophet Micah utilized themes from the day of the Lord to warn of Samaria's looming destruction, Micah 1:3-5. He saw God descending out of his place to tread upon the high places of the earth so that the mountains melt before his arrival. Unlike Christ's prophecy about his coming from the clouds, these passages are found in poetic portions of Scripture, and even then, they reinforce the fact that God appeared in plain sight in his glory cloud during the Exodus from Egypt. The classic example cited by preterists of the Lord's cloud coming is found in the prophecies of Isaiah, Isaiah 19, 1 through 4. This passage begins, "Behold, the Lord is riding on a swift cloud and comes to Egypt." And it continues with a prophecy concerning Egypt's destruction by civil war, harsh servitude, and drought. Preterists and many futurists interpret this passage as referring to the imminent Assyrian invasion of Egypt in the late 7th century BC. Gentry contends that it contains apocalyptic language and that no interpreter believes that the Egyptians saw God Almighty sitting on a cloud and descending among them in judgment. However, the background of this passage calls to mind the Exodus narrative, where God actually appeared in a visible cloud to destroy Pharaoh's Egypt. Furthermore, the surrounding context shows that this passage is ultimately eschatological and will find its culmination in the day of the Lord, when Egypt and Assyria will join Israel in the worship of the one true God, Isaiah 19, 23 through 25. The cumulative evidence from the passage does not deny a literal cloud coming, but affirms it from history and predicts it in eschatology, the gathering of the elect. The Lord continued the Olivet Discourse, and he, the Son of Man, will send out his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. Preterists consistently put forth the notion that the angels are human messengers who would preach the trumpet call of the gospel throughout the nations after the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. Some preterists, such as Gentry, do not appear to be entirely comfortable with their reinterpretation of this passage and admit that it could refer to angelic supernatural power which lies behind such preaching. According to the preterist interpretation, the gathering of the elect in Matthew 24:31 and Mark 13:27 means that Jesus would spiritually bring the elect Gentiles into the Holy Church. For example, R.T. France argues that the destruction of Jerusalem was the cue for the establishment of the universal reign of the Son of Man and the gathering of a new people of God from the ends of the earth. According to Chilton and others, the desolation of Jerusalem made the church the new synagogue, the super synagogue. One difficulty for the preterist interpretation of this verse is that Christ had previously taught in the Olivet Discourse that the worldwide preaching of the gospel must occur before the end of the age, Matthew 24:14. This anachronism is seen most clearly in the preterist's claim that the gospel had already gone to the entire world and to all the nations prior to AD 70. One wonders then how the gospel could have been proclaimed to all the nations before AD 70, while the destruction of Jerusalem signaled the beginning of the same event. Gentry, perceiving this weakness in the preterist argument, suggests that the language of Jesus highlights AD 70 as the ultimate spark for the worldwide mission. Indeed, the events of AD 70 finally separate Christianity from Judaism. He remarks that the worldwide gathering of the Gentiles began in earnest in AD 70. Similarly, Damar attempts to qualify Jesus' statement by positing that the gospel went to the Jew first prior to AD 70 and thereafter went to the Gentiles in new fullness with the expectation that the nations, Gentiles, would be discipled. However, such elastic use of words does not avoid the anachronism. Preterist attempts to explain away the clear meaning of the angelic gathering of the elect also gloss over other well-attested passages of Scripture that clearly describe Christ's return. Dick admits this, Matthew 24:31, some maintain, is a description of the final resurrection at the second coming of the Lord. That there is some ground for such an interpretation, one cannot deny. The trumpet is associated with the resurrection of the dead in several passages. One passage that exemplifies Christ's teaching about the gathering of the elect at the angelic trumpet call is the Apostle Paul's exposition on the passage. The Apostle taught that the descent of Jesus from heaven will be accompanied by at least one angel, the sound of a trumpet call, and the gathering of his elect in the clouds. In his correspondence with the Corinthians, Paul also connected the return of Jesus with the last trumpet and the resurrection of the dead. Other passages describe the revealing of the Lord Jesus from heaven with the accompaniment of mighty angels to render judgment. Jesus provided the interpretation of a parable about the angelic end-time gathering in the Synoptic Gospels. These words clarify the meaning of Matthew 24:31 by identifying the angels and their role in the harvest gathering. The harvest is at the end of the age, and the reapers are angels. Just as the weeds are gathered and burned with fire, so will it be at the end of the age. The Son of Man will send his angels, and they will gather out of his kingdom all causes of sin and all lawbreakers, and throw them into the fiery furnace. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then the righteous will shine like the sun in the kingdom of their Father. He who has ears, let him hear. Matthew 13:39-43. This passage identifies the angels as heavenly beings by describing their role of separating out the evildoers and throwing them into the fiery furnace of hell, hardly the function of earthly preachers of the gospel. Admittedly, Jesus did not formally depict the gathering of the elect in these verses, yet in the original parable, he mentioned that he will gather the wheat, the righteous, into his barn. In addition, he mentioned that the righteous will shine like the sun in the kingdom, an allusion to the resurrection prophecy of Daniel. Many of them who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, and those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the sky above, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. Daniel 12:2. Based on these facts, we see that Christ's parable directly connects this angelic harvest gathering with the resurrection of dead at the end of the age. In the Isaiah apocalypse, the prophet Isaiah also connected the same eschatological events that Jesus later predicted in the Olivet Discourse. For example, Isaiah prophesied that the day of the Lord would be characterized by devastations upon the earth, an unprecedented earthquake, the darkening of the sun and moon, Yahweh's reign in Jerusalem, and the divine punishment of rebellious angels and the kings of the earth. After the national birth pains of tribulation, the Lord himself will return from heaven to destroy the sea beast and to swallow up death forever and wipe away tears from all faces through the resurrection of the dead. He will save those who have waited for him and will provide a luxurious banquet for them in Mount Zion. Like one who gleans grain in the harvest, God will gather the people of Israel back to their own land at the blast of the great trumpets. In that day, from the river Euphrates to the brook of Egypt, the Lord will thresh out the grain, and you will be gleaned one by one, O people of Israel. And in that day, a great trumpet will be blown, and those who are lost in the land of Assyria and those who were driven out to the land of Egypt will come and worship the Lord on the holy mountain at Jerusalem. Isaiah 27:12-13.